This is the moment.
What moment?
I just told you that you can't save me. And you're going to try to anyway. In the bar the night we met, you asked me about the moment I fell in love with you. This is the moment.
Welcome back to the Cephalopodcast, where we are discussing the HBO show Watchmen. I am your host, Scott.
I'm Jason.
Today we are discussing Season 1, Episode 8, which is entitled A God Walks Into A-Bar. A-Bar being Angela and Cal's last name, so clearly this is a reference to Dr. Manhattan being one of the A-Bars. In this episode, clearly it's Cal. Episode opens, we see the backside of someone walking down a street. It's a blue guy. It's after a Dr. Manhattan parade like we saw in the last episode. And ultimately, he ends up walking into a bar where he sees Angela. This is a slightly younger Angela A-Bar. They are at a bar called Eddie's Bar. I did make note that before he walks in, do you remember that there was that Dr. Manhattan graffiti on the side of the building from the last episode? Where Angela was a kid, so this is essentially 20 years later, and that graffiti is still there, but it has been covered up, and now Dr. Manhattan has like a big spray painted on dong on him.
Yeah,
and I couldn't really tell. It almost looked like maybe they put like a cigarette in his mouth too, but I just thought it was funny that 20 years later he's still up there, but now he's got a penis. What we see is whoever this person is. They're all covered. Their skin is blue. So either they've painted their skin blue, or maybe this is really Dr. Manhattan. We don't know. He's wearing a mask that he picks up on the street. Ultimately, he walks over and he has a discussion with Angela, introduces himself and basically says, "Hey, I'm Dr. Manhattan. And, you know, I see time differently and I'm in love with you and you're amazing and you should go out with me." And she clearly doesn't believe him, because this seems like the worst pickup line in the world. Like, "Hey, I'm Dr. Manhattan. We should go have dinner later, right?" It's established in this timeline, or in this scene, that this is 20 years after Vietnam. So this is before Angela joins the police force and before her and Cal get married. This is their introduction story, essentially. Dr. Manhattan attempts to convince Angela that... she says, "Where have you been for the last 20 years? You know, you won Vietnam and then you disappeared. You know, everybody says you're on Mars." And he says, "No, I'm not on Mars. I've really been on Europa," which is one of Jupiter's moons. And he starts to explain to her his existence and how he exists in all time, or all space and all time at the same time. So at one point he says he is simultaneously on Europa creating life and in the bar with Angela. So he perceives time differently. I think we've talked about that in the past. And basically, he says that he's created life on Jupiter, or on Europa. He's essentially created Adam and Eve. He's created the perfect utopia, I guess. And so his line was, "The entire process is complete in approximately 90 seconds. And Angela's response, she says, "Oh, typical." And he says, "I'm sorry." And Angela says, "A man creating life in under two minutes," you know, and in his Dr. Manhattan, like super dry voice, he replies, "Oh, a sex joke." So ultimately what we see is like there's some cuts to Europa, and he's created Adam and Eve, which are, we've seen from the previous episodes, are Crookshanks and Mr. Phillips. And he wanted to get away from he wanted to get away from humanity. He ultimately says, I think he says it's boring and that it's, you know, there's too much conflict, and he wanted to go somewhere where there was no conflict. And so he goes to Europa and creates his own utopia.
Yeah, I guess it's based on, like, the two people are based on him as a kid, like, encountering like a lord and his wife in this castle. He goes into a little bit of backstory about that, like why Crookshanks is that particular man and or a girl, and then Mr. Phillips is the man. and the castle is represented in this sort of backstory of him as a child.
So, ultimately that, there's what a flashback to him as a kid to, you know, little, John Osterman as a kid. And he talks about how his father was a Jewish watchmaker and they're at this castle, which, you know, again, when you're a kid, you know, everything seems amazing and great. And I think at one point, doesn't he say that this was the first place I knew love was at this castle? You know, I mean, he's young and he's impressionable.
Well, literally, he knew the first place he knew love, literally, right?
So that's right. Ultimately, he ends up like peeping Tomming like Crookshanks and Phillips, like having sex in, you know, from the closet because that, you know, he doesn't mean to catch them. But and that's his line. This is the first time I know love. And I think this is an innocent line. I mean, what do you think? I mean, he was, I don't know, what, 9 in that episode, you know, and he sees these two people who are, you know, in love with each other and they're, you know, they're having sex. And I don't think like he was like super pervin on him. I think he was like, he grew up without a mother, right? Because didn't he say his mom left and his dad was very detached? So he probably didn't really know what two people that were in love were like until he saw, you know, Crookshanks and Phillips going at it, right?
Yeah, no, I didn't think anything weird from him as like a little kid, obviously, but like I thought it was a little weird that those two adults like really had to like get him aside and like explain everything and everything. Like,
separate him from his dad, right? They're like, hang on, can we talk to him alone?
They basically
have to explain sex to him, and they're like, well, we were trying to create a life.
Yeah, it's at that part of it seemed weird. Seemed like they could just say, hey, go back to your parents or whatever. Yeah.
Got kids, right? Like if somebody like you don't know these people, right? And somebody comes up to you like, hey, can I talk to your daughter alone for a couple minutes? You're going to be like, what the fuck are you talking
and
about?
Teach them about sex. Like,
like it's so weird. Ultimately, they give him a gift. You know, they sort of apologize and they, you know, they're being nice to him and they give him a gift. They give him a Holy Bible and they tell him there's all these cool stories in it. They talk about Genesis being the beginning of, you know, the universe. And I think at one point it cuts and there's a picture of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. So we're getting some serious, you know, pre-utopia, what's the moon called? Europa. I already lost it. So getting some pre-Europa vibes. And what they, you know, as they're leaving or as young John is about to leave, the line is, when you leave this place, long after, when you grow into a man in America, make it your purpose to create something beautiful. And he says, or his response, or I mean, whatever, the next one of the next lines is, 7 decades later and 390 million miles away, I fulfill my promise. So he does it. I mean, he creates, you know, this, you know, Garden of Eden, I guess, on Europa.
Mm-hmm. Where fetuses come out of the pond.
I suppose. Where he's right.
Okay.
I mean, I'm trying to see how much. Yeah, I mean, he talks about. Yeah, he makes the entire. I mean, this is the sex joke from earlier. He does the entire thing in 90 seconds. He's got some power here, but it's not clear, you know, why he does this or what. I mean, this is clearly all set up for later in the episode. So this is we're seeing the origin of, you know, wherever Vite was. We cut back to Eddie's bar, you know, and we see Angela is just like not buying any of this. Like she's just a lonely girl. She's at this bar. She's mourning the death anniversary of her parents. And, you know, this guy walks in and basically tells her, I'm a god. And he makes up this story. And she's just absolutely convinced this is a pickup line and she doesn't want anything to do with them. And her line is, so tell me, if you went through all of this trouble to create the Garden of Eden, then why'd you leave? And his response was, so I could meet you. What do you think?
Oh, I don't know. I don't really buy this whole relationship at all, but I mean, she agrees to go on a date and then like takes him to a morgue. To like try on some bodies or something?
Yeah. So before, right before that, she still put off. She was like, no, if you really are Dr. Manhattan, like, basically screw you, dude. Like, my parents are dead because of you. Like, you radicalized some Vietnamese soldier after you killed all these Vietnamese people, and he went on and became a suicide bomber and killed my parents. So basically, you're responsible for my parents' death. I still don't want anything to do with you. And I thought, so Dr. Manhattan says, well, if it makes you feel any better, I regret doing it now. And this whole time, like, he's convincing her that I see time differently. I see the beginning, I see the end, I see the middle. And so she says, well, why would you, you know, because he said he regrets it. She said, then you must have known that you would end up regretting it before you even did it. So why do it anyway? Which is a great question, right? Like, why go to all this trouble? Why kill all these people? Why go to all of this, cause all this havoc in a bajillion people's lives if you know you're going to end up regretting it? And that line kind of struck me. I was like, yeah, you know, like, what would it be like to be able to see all your choices before you make them? And then his response, like, without missing a beat, he says, well, haven't you ever done anything you knew you were going to regret? And then I was like, oh, I mean, like, how many times have, like, you sat down to, like, have a really big meal and you're like, oh my gosh, I'm going to regret this later, but I'm going to enjoy it right now kind of thing. Or how many times you've been, oh, I'm going to stay up really late tonight because I'm really into, you know, whatever this game or book I'm reading. And then you're exhausted the next day. Like, it's not simple to just be able to say, I know this is a bad choice, I'm not going to do it. Right. That's fundamentally what he's saying, is sometimes things are more important than just regret. Right.
Yeah, but it's not satisfying for me. It's not an answer. It doesn't tell us why his character wanted to do it. Why was it something that he wanted to do so bad that he was going to regret it later? That doesn't answer that question.
Well, he responds because he did it so he could meet Angela. If he didn't, you know, end the Vietnam War, they never would have met.
Oh, okay. I guess I missed that part.
So
he did the whole thing so he could meet Angela.
Ultimately, I mean, that's what he says.
That's weird.
I mean, he really likes this girl. I don't know.
See, the idea that this omnipresent guy can fall in love with some singular woman for some reason. Well, maybe it's all predetermined and it's like outside of his control, maybe. I could see that.
I mean, that's fundamentally what this episode and what the Dr. Manhattan character is all about. It's about fate versus predetermination, right?
Yeah.
Or free will versus predetermination.
Yeah. The main problem I have is, like, her going along with it. Like, this is like the worst relationship decision that you could ever make. This guy's like a monster, you know? Like, he's not someone you settle down with. I'll say that, you know, but
you think so? Okay. So playing devil's advocate, like, if you're in her shoes and somebody comes down and convinces you legitimately that they are a god and they have these powers, like, you're not going to be intrigued. You're not going to be like, huh? You know, I mean, I'll go along with this for a while. Just see where this goes. Cause it's one of those once in a lifetime opportunities. I mean, she doesn't agree to marry him right away. Like, that comes later. She falls in love with him later. She's very skeptical.
I guess I'm less concerned with, like, her motivations. Sure, I guess her motivations seem okay. But, like, the setup for this relationship, to me, it just feels really contrived and, like, you know, like a little, like, reinforcing gender roles a bit. I guess we can get into that later. Yeah. But, like, it's just, I didn't love it, but, you know. I guess I get what you're saying about he doesn't really have control of all of this destiny stuff. Like, he doesn't have control over what happens to his future or his past, and so he had to do the things he did.
I mean, that's how the episode ends, right? I mean, I think that's where it goes, right? The star wipe right before is him saying, mm-hmm. We didn't have a choice.
Yeah, well, it's a crazy concept,
let's not get ahead of ourselves. Do you want to talk about the quick scene in the morgue?
And they kind of look into this. She's sort of aware of all these people that died with no families.
I think she's an MP in the army, I think, and I think those are just dead soldiers that don't have family, so she has access to the morgue, is the impression I got.
Yeah, I guess so. So that she can like let him take over someone's body because they don't have a family. And so they pick out like a pretty sexy looking black dude, I guess. Because that's
yeah, she wants to go out on the town, and she said, I can't go out. I can't take you on a date if you're a blue guy, right? Even in Vietnam, like people are going to look. So she needs him to look like someone that she could go on a date with. Yeah. Did you notice that the first three guys she pulled out that gives him the choice there, you know, I think one of them or two of them were Vietnamese. One was a white guy. There were no black guys in those first three. And then he says, well, why don't you pick unless there's one that you haven't, you know, shown me yet. And then she pulls out like this hot looking black guy. And she's, well, how about this guy? Right.
Hey, yeah. You know, oh, I have this jacked guy over here, by the way. Sure.
Yeah. Right.
Okay. Yeah, he's a good-looking actor.
Yeah. And let's see. Yeah. So what happens after that is, yeah, they're back. The time kind of jumps around in this, and I think it's done on purpose just to show you how Dr. Manhattan lives and thinks and whatnot. But so they're back in the bar on the first night that they've met again, and he's telling her he's still trying to convince her to go out with him. And he says that they end up having a 10-year relationship. They fall in love, they get married, they have kids. And but it ends in tragedy. And she says, oh yeah? Well, you know, how does it end? And he says, well, I won't tell you that. And then at one point, he's still trying to convince her to go out with him. He says, well, your favorite song is about to play on the jukebox. Right? And he pauses, and then he says, now, and then like the record drops. And whatever song comes on, I didn't write that one down, I should have. She says, well, you're wrong, because I've never even heard this song before. And he's right. I mean, it does. It becomes her favorite song later because of the way he perceives time. It becomes her favorite song because it was a song that was playing when they met. Right? She doesn't know it, but it becomes her favorite song later. So to him, because everything's happening, you know, simultaneously, it's, I guess, always been her favorite song.
Mm-hmm.
And it cuts to them like 6 months in the future, and they're having sex, and they're having he knows they're going to have an argument. He's explaining this argument that they're going to have. And Angela says, where are you? You know, mid sex, cause he's distracted, which is kind of his MO. It's in the comic too. He says, I'm in the bar the night we met just before I created the egg. And she's like, kind of gets mad. She's like, what the hell? Like, we're literally, I mean, say, like, you can't be present with me. You can't be not distracted for, you know, however long it takes to do this. And she gets frustrated with him. And she is kind of yelling at him, like, you know, you don't have anything to be afraid of. You're a god. Like, when was the last time you were afraid? Because that's a very human emotion, is being afraid. It runs a lot of our lives and fuels our emotions. And that's something that Dr. Manhattan doesn't really have to worry about, because he's, you know, all powerful and all knowing. And he says, the last time I was afraid was 50 years ago when he was in the intrinsic field generator. And he goes into detail about, you know, how his origin story and how it ripped his body apart. And she just like laughs at him. She's like, are you serious? Like, get the heck out of here. Like, the last time you were afraid was 50 years ago. Like, I'm afraid every day. Like, my life is terrible. You know, like, that's the nature of the human condition. She's frustrated with him. And his response was, no, Angela, I'm being torn apart right now. So, because to him, everything is happening all at once, and it's always happening. So he's in the middle of having sex with her, and he's being torn apart in the field generator, and he's seeing them break up, and he's seeing them in the past.
But why does he have to tell her mid-sex that he's in a different place? It just seems like poor tact.
Well, that's that. Yeah, I mean, I think that's Dr. Manhattan's disconnect with humanities. He doesn't understand human emotions, or he doesn't communicate the way that humans expect, and clearly that frustrates him. That same thing happened with him and Laurie's relationship when they were younger too. So this is, it's just, you know, he's just sort of out of touch. I mean, he's a god. Like, if you are a god and you see all these things and you know all these things, how do you relate to somebody who lives on a linear timeline and, you know, A to B to C. Like, that's got to be so boring and simple. Like, I mean, of course he's going to be thinking about other things while they're in the middle of sex. That's the nature of having you know, your boyfriend is a god, right?
So is that why he goes to Vite and gets that thing device to, like?
Yes, absolutely. That's the next scene. Do you want to talk about it? You can take the next scene when Dr. Manhattan zaps. He zaps out of the bedroom. Right, they have that fight, and she says, "You need to leave." And he essentially snaps his fingers and just, you know, I guess beams himself to Antarctica, and that's Vite's secret base from the comic. That's where he launched the squid attack.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So Dr. Manhattan zaps himself to Antarctica and walks into Vite's base.
Yeah, and like Vite is talking about some device that he made that will like shut down Dr. Manhattan's powers and like not and take away his memories, and so he takes him up on that and so like basically agrees to that. And then Angela.
Yeah, but why does he agree to that? You skipped a couple things. Why does Dr. Manhattan want to?
Because he wants to, like, love Angela, I guess.
He wants to have a relationship. He realizes that he can't do it as a god. He wants to, you know, have a better relationship with Angela. He wants to not be a god for a little while.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's about it. And then also, Dr. Manhattan talks to Vite about his utopia and like entices him to go there and be like a god, you know, in this utopia. So I guess that's where he decides to go there. And that's what leads to hit that whole weird stuff with the clones and the Crookshanks and the game wardens and all of that. He ends up there. But we still don't know all the answers to that.
Right.
Yes. And so we see Angela put this little ring device thing into John's forehead, which, you know, makes him lose all his powers, lose all his memory, you know, kind of. So I don't understand. I guess I kind of get it, but like, why is this something that Angela wants to do? Why does she want to babysit this god guy who is not going to remember her before this thing? Has to like tell him a story about an accident. If they really love each other, why is she okay with just like erasing his memory?
Well, the scene right before this, she was really frustrated that he was a god, that he was not present, and that she's mm-hmm. just as frustrated trying to be in a relationship with a god as he is dealing with her, right? I think this just sort of levels the playing field for her, because at one point he says, "I won't forget you, I will still love you, I just won't remember who I am." So it's just a way of putting them on the same level.
I just don't understand what about him she loves then. Is it him as the god, or is it just this black guy that the body he took over? And it's like, okay, get rid of the god part, I'll take the body, I guess.
Yeah, I guess that's a good question. Like, how much of his personality goes with, yeah, with his powers? I don't know. That's a good question. Yeah, it does. It seems really risky. I mean, even Vite, you know, says, "I'm not exactly sure how this is going to work."
Yeah.
You know, let's back up just a little bit. So when Dr. Manhattan gets to Antarctica, he says, when he walks in, Vite says, "Welcome back to Antarctica, John," because this is where the end of the comic takes place. And he mentions, you know, he says, "How long has it been since I've seen you?" And Dr. Manhattan says, 24 years, 41 days, and 13 hours. So it's 2009 in Antarctica at this point. So this is well after the comic has concluded. And Dr. Manhattan walks over. He's, you know, Vite's working on a machine, and we see, you know, we see little squids falling, that like we saw in the squid falls from the very first episode. And Dr. Manhattan says, "Oh, still fabricating alien incursions, I see." And Vite's response is, "Maintaining world peace, one cephalopod at a time." So it's been 24 years since the original gigantic squid attack on New York. And Vite is still up to his old tricks. like you said, he's watching the news. He's got like a wall of TVs, and there's, I think there's something about like a nuclear meltdown or something, and he's frustrated. He's like, why are these people still doing this? I've given them, you know, unlimited power and energy. Why are they still pursuing the bomb? And yeah, so he basically says that I have this chip for you that'll make you forget. And he said, actually, I thought it was interesting. He says that, doesn't he say that the chip was plan A and what actually happens in the end of the comic was plan B, or maybe it was the other way around? So Veidt was working around Dr. Manhattan powers in the original comic, and it comes back to him now. So he's already had this. He says, I had this chip. I made it 30 years ago. I used it. I had it in my back pocket just in case things went south on the first squid attack. And it's just been sitting here. And he gets like a little ring box out of his pocket. And he says, tell me, John, do you know what's inside this? And Dr. Manhattan can see everything. And he kind of looks at the box and he like tilts his head. And he says, actually, I don't. And he's very confused by that because it's not very common that he doesn't know what's going on. And Veidt says, well, I irradiated it with tachyon arrays or whatever. And so he's created a blind spot for Dr. Manhattan. Which, if you're writing a story about a god, right, Superman has his kryptonite, right? You can't have an omnipresent, non-omnipotent being without some sort of Achilles heel, because you can't write a story about that, because that person will always come out on top. So in this case, Veidt has figured out like at least this one little niche in Dr. Manhattan's armor, and that he was able to create this, in essence, this ring that he can use against him.
Oh, and so are you saying that that is connected to his demise at the end of the episode?
Yes. Well,
do they explain that or not in this episode?
Not in this episode, no. But not really.
But there is a connection between this and that, like, teleport ray thing that kills him at the end.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
So Veidt has been doing his thing down in Antarctica for 24 years. He's, you know, calling in squid attacks and watching the news and just being, you know, whatever, being Elon Musk and being frustrated that he doesn't control the world. And he says, I don't even know if it was all worth it. You know, I went to all of this trouble to save humanity from the bomb. Am I even going to live long enough to see the utopia that I really wanted to? You know, I'm a lonely dude. I'm sitting down here in Antarctica with nobody but my TVs. Like, he's questioning his life choices. Like, maybe I should have just let us blow us up. I mean, like, I'm miserable. And Dr. Manhattan says, you know, I've got this utopia. I created it on Europa. Like, I can send you there. And so that's what they do, is they agree to a trade, right? I'll send you to Europa. You can be the lord of this manor that's essentially the Garden of Eden. And you give me this, you know, chip or whatever, put in my brain, and we both get what we want. Dr. Manhattan's line was, I sought to create a kind of life that was superior to the life here on Earth. Kinder, gentler, beings who are designed to care for others instead of themselves. So he's seen, Dr. Manhattan has seen the worst of humanity, and he's created this new utopia, and he's offering it to Veidt as a trade. Utopia, he says, utopia is teeming with life and devoid of conflict and boring. So even Dr. Manhattan is boring. He's like, I created, in essence, this perfect world, and nothing ever happens there. There's no conflict. There's nothing interesting going on. And he says, They're on Europa right now. They're just waiting for someone to worship. And so they agree to this trade, and he sends Veidt to Europa, and he says, Godspeed, you know, as he snaps his fingers or whatever, and he disappears, right? So just another reference to Dr. Manhattan being a god. And then, yeah, we see Angela, like you said, he pushes this, you know, ring or whatever, this device that Veidt has created. And Angela has the ring, and she says, do you want to get down on one knee? Like, he's going to propose to her because she has the ring. And then she puts this thing into his head, and that's it. And so we're seeing Cal's origin story, where he, you know, he turns from Dr. Manhattan into Cal so that he can be in a relationship with Angela. But it cuts back to Eddie's bar, and Angela is demanding proof. So we're back in, you know, the night that they've met. And she says, all right, well, do some sort of magic trick or something, because I still just think you're some creepy dude trying to pick me up in a bar. And Dr. Manhattan holds out his two hands, closes his hands, and one of his hands opens, and there's an egg in his hand. And he proceeds to tell her that we get married and we have kids. And again, we live happily for 10 years until tragedy. And so she calls him out again, and she says, oh, that's bullshit. She's like, I don't want kids. There's no way I'm going to have kids. Like, you can't be telling me the truth. Well, clearly we don't get together. We don't live happily ever after for 10 years, because I would never want to have kids. So she's still not buying it. I mean, clearly we know it works out, right? Because we, you know, it keeps cutting into the future, and we know that they end up getting married. But this is just, you know, here's, you know, a regular girl. She's probably in her, what, 20s or 30s in this bar, and some weird guy's trying to pick her up, and she's really making him work for it. Like, I don't think, you know, you're on the up and up. He does mention that there is a period of time. Oh, she asks where the kids come from. Who do they adopt them from, or something like that? And he says, I don't know. I cannot see. He said, there's a period of time that I cannot see. I can see before you and I got together, and I can see after you and I got together, but not during. So he's referencing that even as his omnipotent self, he loses his powers while he's Cal. When she puts that thing in his brain, he, as Dr. Manhattan, doesn't have any memories of their relationship while they're together. He doesn't remember them adopting the kids. You want to talk to... So after she puts it in his... Or after... Now it cuts back to present day when she, you know, takes it out of his brain.
Basically, she says, like, he's in danger. And he's, like, emerging as, like, the Blue Man group. And...
Right.
He seems confused. And she seems a little afraid of what's going on with him. Trying to convince him who he is and whatnot. And he... As Dr. Manhattan, glowing, comes out on the pool and says, I have to stand on the pool to show you. And she's like, nah, you don't really. You're,
like the seventh Capro, he's coming. You're and he's fine. Like, no, I got to walk on this pool. Hang on a second.
Yeah. And he's like, zaps the kids. He says that they're in a theater with the grandpa, Will.
They're in the Dreamland Theater that we see in the very first episode.
Sure. Yeah. And they're safe. But there was a moment where she, like, freaks out about the kids. And a moment I thought could have been really interesting, almost freaky, is, like, the idea that he could maybe wipe out their entire history in a moment. Like, suddenly they don't have kids together and their relationship never happened because he's just so indifferent to it. But that's not really what happens. He's kind of explaining the situation, I guess, or he's... explaining about the cavalry outside watching their house. He knows about how they have a squad outside with this like death ray thing, or it's like a transporter. He says that they're going to transport him to another location to destroy him, and it's just going to happen. He says that's how it goes.
He's very calm about it, right? He's very matter of fact. He's like, look, it's going to happen. It's I've seen it. There's nothing I can do about it. She's trying to protect him, and he was like, eh, what are you going to do?
Yeah, and so I think at this point we cut to the scene with the grandpa, like, before the action part with the cavalry.
Real quick before you cut, there's two things from that previous scene. Number one, we see that, Dr. Manhattan says, oh, this clock is damaged. And she says, yeah, do you remember how that clock got damaged? Because on the white night, the 7th Cavalry broke in and they fired a shot in Angela's house and it hit the clock and it broke the clock. And remember, that 7th Cavalry member was right on Angela's face when she was on the ground with the shotgun, and then it cuts. And obviously we know that she lives. Well, that's the reveal is that under stress, Dr. Manhattan can come out of Cal. And that's what happened is during that scene when they were both being attacked, Dr. Manhattan emerged very quickly, just enough to save Angela from the 7th Cavalry, and then went dormant again. And then the other
thing... Is that important to know that, like, under this ring thing, he still has reflexes? Yeah, because they kind of... He says, oh, I guess you don't have powers. I guess maybe as a reflex, and that's indicated in this episode. Is that important later? Because it didn't seem important because he's now out of the ring, right? He's not. The ring is no longer controlling him, but maybe it does later?
No, I don't think so. I think it's just to give explanation of how she survived the White Knight, if I remember it. I don't think there's anything in the last episode that comes up about that, but...
Okay.
The only other thing in that episode is he's walking on the swimming pool. He's just doing his Jesus thing. He's walking on the water. And she was like, okay, you've walked on the water. Like, let's go. Let's go save the kids. Like, let's get out of here. The 7th Cavalry are coming. And he was like, no, it's important that you see me. Or she asked, why is it important? Like, why are you walking on? He's like, it's important. And she's like, why is it important? Like, we got stuff we got to do. And he says, and he pauses and he said, it's important that you see me do this.
Yeah, I didn't understand that even watching this episode, I guess, but is that must be important for
it
some
comes, it
later.
Comes back. Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
And then, those are just the two things. And do you want to talk real quick about, so Cal goes and visits Will Reeves?
I think he's talking with Angela and says, like, when Vite gave me this device, he says to go, you know, if you have unfinished business, go take care of it. And so then he describes going to Angela's grandfather, Will, 10 years ago or 7 years ago or something, mm-hmm. 10 years ago from that moment in the swimming pool.
So Angela doesn't know who Will is at this point.
Yeah.
But Cal does, and or Dr. Manhattan does, and says, hey, I have business with Will first.
Yeah. So he goes there to talk to him, you know, tells him that he is Dr. Manhattan and has to, you know, does a little tricksy poo and, you know, convinces him. And Will says, okay, I'll listen to you. And basically just tells him that you have a granddaughter, Angela. I know you're Hooded Justice. I want to form an alliance with you. I think that's the extent, you know, that's important. Basically wants to form an alliance. Oh, okay. Well, there's a big moment here where Angela wants to say something to Will in this moment because it's made clear, you know, it's very clear that Dr. Manhattan says he's talking to Will at the same moment that he's talking to Angela. Like, he's doing it right now. And so Angela says, hey, I want to ask him a question. Why did you kill Judd? How did you know Judd was a Cyclops, you know, card-carrying member? And how did you know Judd had a clan robe in his closet? And then, Will, he relays that question through time, which is
across
cool.
space and time. Yeah, like 10 years into the past, yeah. Right?
And it is that's a pretty cool moment. And the pause that that Dr. Manhattan gives when Angela asks, hey, can I ask him a question? There's a little pause he gives, which is cool. He's like, I don't know if this is a good idea. He doesn't immediately say, yeah, I can do that. No, he's like, I guess I could do that. There's not much emotion you get out of Dr. Manhattan, but the little moment like that does mean a lot. And so, yeah, that was really interesting. And so he relays that question to Will 10 years earlier, and Will says, I have no idea who Judd is. Obviously, sort of.
Heard that name before. I don't know who that person is. Yeah. Why would I kill them 10 years in the future? Why does he have a clan robe? Like, what the crap is going on, right?
Yeah.
Will has no idea what he's talking about. And Angela is equally gobsmacked. Like, what do you mean you don't even know who this person is? Why would you go to all this trouble to kill someone anyway?
Well, she figures out pretty quickly that she realizes she just invoked a paradox kind of chicken and egg situation, which Dr. Manhattan comments on this paradox of, like, how could something come first when it happened in the past and so on and so forth.
Dr. Manhattan's line is, the chicken or the egg, which came first? The answer appears to be both.
Yeah, I mean, it all happens at the same time. He seems to be a locust for, like, time and space kind of warping and having problems with each other. It's the idea that Angela's, this investigation didn't originate with Will. It it just originated out of thin air or like by itself. Who knows what instigated it? I'd be really interested to know if they have an answer for that. Like
the crux of every time travel movie, right? I mean,
yeah.
Marty McFly goes back in time and, you know, breaks his parents up and then he's never born, you know, like that's.
Well, it's always the plot hole. Like, yeah.
But it's a cool concept. I mean, yeah. So
they're directly, you know, focusing on that paradox, which is interesting. So, yeah.
And that's it. And then, so the next scene is, Dr. Manhattan is on the water and he says, I am hungry. And he just like beams himself into the kitchen. And Angela's like, oh, what the hell's going on? Like, this guy's walking on my pool. Now he disappears. He's in my kitchen. She's trying to figure out where her kids are. She's trying to get him out of the house because the 7th Cavalry is coming. And she walks back into the house and he's making breakfast. Like, he's floating all this breakfast food around. And there's eggs there, right? There's eggs everywhere. Clearly, if you haven't picked it up by now, there is an egg theme. And she's like, what the fuck are you doing, dude? Why are you making breakfast? Like, the 7th Cavalry is coming. They are going to come kill you. And Cal's like, oh, no, they're already here. I know. They're in a truck across the way with a tachyon gun. Like, I'm really hungry. Don't worry about it. And he says, Angela says, they've been here all this time and you're just now telling me? And his response is, well, there were more important matters to discuss. Because to him, having this discussion with Angela and solving this is way more important than defending himself against the 7th Cavalry. He already knows that the 7th Cavalry are going to kill him or that they're going to beam him out of there or do whatever. Says this is the tragedy. This is that he was talking about on the first night that they met. We have this relationship and it ends in a tragic event 10 years later. This is it. Like he knows this is coming. He's known it's been coming the entire time, so it doesn't even phase him, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's a cool line where Angela doesn't believe it. She was like, look, you can sit here and make breakfast. You can do whatever you want. Like, the 7th Cavalry's coming. I'm a cop. I've got weapons. Like, I'm not going to let him get away with this. And so she decides that she's going to go out and defend Cal. And he says, this is the moment. She's like loading up guns. And he says, this is the moment. And she's like, well, what moment? I just told you that you can't save me and you're going to try to anyway. In that bar, the night we met, you asked me about the moment I fell in love with you. This is the moment. So he's telling her, I fell in love with you 10 years later, right? At the end of their relationship. This is the moment that I really fell in love with you because you're going to, in essence, go out and sacrifice yourself to save me. Even though I'm a god and I've told you that you can't save me, you're going to do it anyway. So in Dr. Manhattan's weird time-ridden brain, you fall in love at the end of the relationship, right? Not at the beginning. So Angela gets her guns. She's still not really listening to Dr. Manhattan. She's like, I'm going to go at least shoot some 7th Cavalry guys before they come in here, right? So she runs out on the front lawn, hiding behind some bushes. She takes out several 7th Cavalry members. I mean, she kind of goes badass and, you know, kills several of them. And Cal just stays in the house, or Dr. Manhattan just stays. He's calm. He's just going to do his thing, kind of stand and look out the window. Again, he knows that there's not a whole lot he can do about this, so he's just chill. Angela jumps in this truck of one of the 7th Cavalry members and basically slams on the gas to, you know, try and run some of them over. She's shooting at the windshield. I don't know, how many 7th Cavalry members do you think she killed? I mean, it was at least a half dozen, right? She took out several.
Yeah, a half dozen is conservative.
Yeah, she did a pretty good job, considering it's one versus, I don't know, 12, whatever. I think she did a pretty good job. Mm-hmm. Anyway, she jumps in this truck and she slams on the gas. And, you know, I think she hits one or two of them. And one of the 7th Cavalry members, I mean, there's still at least a half dozen standing, walks over to the passenger side door of this truck and opens the truck, shines a flashlight in and a shotgun. And like, this is the end. Like, there's no way that Angela gets out of this, right? Mm-hmm. She's at the end of her line. It's, you know, she's taken out several of them, but there's way more than he can survive. And then from behind this guy that has drawn this shotgun down on Angela, we see the guy explode, and then we see Cal there, and he's doing his Dr. Manhattan thing. That what he does there is exactly what he did in Vietnam, except he made himself really big, like 100 feet tall in Vietnam. And he just sort of walks around waving his hand, and people just explode. I mean, this is his power, right? He's a god. He can do those sorts of things. And he comes out, and he basically starts disintegrating a bunch of 7th Cavalry members. He kind of stops some bullets that are in the air, like Neo from the Matrix style. And he saves Angela's life. And I wrote down that this is kind of the definition of a deus ex machina, where she is in a situation that is completely out of her control. There's no way that she can save this. She doesn't have any friends around. It's not like, you know, her cop friends are going to show up, or, you know, Topher is going to come out with a shotgun. Like, there's no other hope. And then what happens is Dr. Manhattan does his Dr. Manhattan thing, and he is a god, right? So the only way that she gets out of this situation is this insane one in a million shot of Dr. Manhattan doing his Dr. Manhattan thing. And she says, after he kills everybody, she's killed whatever, half of them, Dr. Manhattan comes out, cleans up the rest. There's nobody left standing. And Angela smiles. She like relaxes, and she says, "We win. You were wrong." She's, you know, excited to have proven him wrong, that there's no 7th Cavalry left. But that's not true. He says, "No, Angela." And then that the laser on the back of that truck like kicks on and basically disintegrates Dr. Manhattan. Was there anybody manning that gun, or was it automatic?
I thought some injured dude climbed up and did it. That's what I thought, but I
don't honestly know. It wasn't, you know, there may have been, like you said, like one guy left at the end that had just enough power to run the gun or whatever, but ultimately there was enough. I mean, it only takes one, and they fire this crazy laser at Dr. Manhattan, and he gets, in essence, disintegrated or teleported or both. And Angela loses it. And that's kind of the end of the episode. The very last thing is it cuts back to Eddie's bar at the beginning, you know, the first time they meet. And I think Angela says, you know, why would I want to get into a relationship that ends in a tragedy? You know, I mean, why set myself up for disaster? I could go marry a dentist and we could live 50 years with no tragedy, right? And Dr. Manhattan has a great line. He says, by definition, don't all relationships end in tragedy? So in one form or another, no matter how you go into a relationship, you're going to break up. One of you is going to die. The best case scenario is, you know, not going to be good. You're definitely not going to live forever. You're not going to live happily ever after. There will be some tragedy and there will be some loss in your life, no matter what happens. And I mean, that this is, again, him still trying to convince her to go out with him. Like, hey, I'm a god and I'm telling you there's going to be some tragedy, but I'm telling you that up front. If you went out with somebody else, you don't get that guarantee. I'm guaranteeing you, in essence, 10 years of happiness because I've seen it. It just happens to end in tragedy. And then that's it. Starwipe, episode over. Closing music I wrote down is a woman, a lover, a friend. And then that's it. And there's a small scene after the credits. Do you want to talk about that scene? Did you watch that?
Yeah, I did catch that. The follow-up on the Vite thing in Europa.
The Vite trial, yes, because they, in essence, convicted him.
Sure. So he's, like, tied up, and they're smashing tomatoes in his face, telling him to stay, and he won't stay. He says he won't, or whatever, and then he's, like, in a prison afterwards, reading a book. The game warden comes in and, you know, I don't know. He just seems angry about it. And he brings a cake, like the same cake we've seen. They're like angry at each other because Vite is a man, a human, and the game warden is a clone. And this is a really weird interaction it's just some weird dialogue between Vite and this guy. Like Vite talks about, oh, there's 8 million people on Earth that are just little babies. They want me back. Or, you know, I think it's just all manipulation from him. And then it's a really weird set of dialogue, which, you know, I gotta hand it to them. It's convincing in a weird way. It's convincing to me in the respect that I kind of believe this game warden guy is a clone that really respects this planet, and he's angry at Vite for not respecting it, and Vite is kind of just doing everything he can to like weasel his way through the situation.
You got to remember, this is at the end of the trial, right? I think they said in the last episode that the trial went on for 365 days. And it went on for a long time. I do know that. And Vite didn't take it seriously. He didn't offer any defense. Like, they ended the trial, and Vite didn't offer any defense. And now here he is, and they're asking him to stay. They're trying to... And he's just like, no. I mean, like, Vite, he's just so bored. He's so... He wanted to come and be the ruler of this place so bad because he wanted to see his utopia. And then he gets here, and it's just... It's boring. There's nothing going on, and it's not what he wanted.
But that's not the case. That's what this kind of makes you lead to believe, like, it's boring, but that's not the case. He was restricted so much in this. There's, like, rules about him killing cows and like, trying to do things to, you know, like, all these rules. So it wasn't that he was bored. It was that there was a bunch of weird rules.
Why are there rules?
That part of it isn't explained yet, right? So
would there be rules in Utopia? Why would there be rules in the Garden of Eden?
Exactly. Yeah. So that's still the lingering question, second episode to the last, about this situation. You describe it as him being bored, and I'm just saying, like, no, there's more to it than that. But he gives them this cake. It's the same cake we've seen over and over.
There were, I believe, 6 candles on this cake, so this is his 6th anniversary of being on this planet.
Okay, and then so he blows out the candles, and then, like, he sees a little something in the cake, and he pulls out a horseshoe, like a really shiny silver horseshoe, and he's, like, super excited about it. And I'm like, oh, this is like a magic horseshoe. He's going to just be able to use it to zap back to Earth, right? He's very excited about it. But no, he kind of uses it just to start digging below the jail cell. And he's, like, very quickly just chipping away at, like, dirt with this horseshoe.
I mean, do you remember in the, whatever it was, the 2nd or 3rd episode, when they give him a cake, he... gives him a horseshoe, and we both kind of went, oh, that's weird. Why does he do that? Mr. Phillips was confused. Like, why does he give him a horseshoe? If you remember, Vite says, oh, I don't need this yet.
Okay. Well, it didn't make any sense at the time, but I remember a horseshoe, you know, in the scene somewhere, but it didn't make any sense at the time, and now it still doesn't really make sense because it doesn't seem to be that helpful. But so such is the show, and that is the end, basically, right?
Yep, and that's the end. So yes, that is definitely explained in the next episode what the horseshoe is for. We get a lot more of Lady True and the Millennium Clock. And Dr. Manhattan and Angela and all of that.
Yeah, so that's what I'm thinking. Like, something with these rules has to do with not Dr. Manhattan, but the other end of the spectrum, where with Lady True and, like, her having this weird statue of him for some reason. She's connected to him, you know, somehow. And so, yeah, the reason you bring... Or the way you bring that up quickly after we just talked about that, that scene makes me, like, I'm trying to, like, claw away, like, clues from the way you describe things, and that's one clue, I think. I don't know. Okay.
A couple little things that, now that we have the reveal that Cal is Dr. Manhattan, there was a scene, I believe it was at the funeral, Judd's funeral, before the bomb goes off, when Lori walks up and introduces herself to Angela and Cal. And you have to remember that Lori and Dr. Manhattan had a relationship for a long time. So when Lori meets Cal, who is Dr. Manhattan, he doesn't know it. She says something, oh, haven't we met before? And he was like, no, I don't think so. And she's like, huh, okay, you just look really familiar kind of thing. Like, so there's like a little bit of a, you know, I don't know if she's picking up on it or if it's just a throwaway for the fans. And then, you know, she's talking to Angela later and she's like, man, your husband is really hot. Like, well, yeah, because that was your boyfriend from 50 years ago. So there's just a lot of little throwbacks to that. That was the one that stood out. I think there's a couple mm-hmm. other, you know, mentions of who Dr. Manhattan could be or.
Yeah.
Or whatnot that have come up previously that I picked up because I knew Cal was Dr. Manhattan. So there's like even now that I've watched this multiple times, there's things where I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, that does make sense because later you find out that this, you know, such and such happened, right? Like I didn't remember what happened with the horseshoe, but I mean, right? That's your Chekhov's gun. That was what, episode 2? And it doesn't circle back until episode 8? This is your brick joke all over again, right? You know, that it starts in the first scene of the episode and doesn't come back until the end. So I guess I don't think it's too much of a spoiler, but I'll give you that, you know, the eggs are a Chekhov's gun, really, right? I mean, that's clearly been a thing. It's going to that will come back. So
why is that a Chekhov's gun?
Just because it's introduced so early and it comes back later, I suppose.
But what can you do with an egg?
Yeah, what could? I don't know. Guess we'll have to watch the next episode and find out.
Okay.
Well, I mean, not to give too much away, but Dr. Manhattan talks about eggs in this episode, right? They have a discussion. Yeah. He makes eggs. They have a discussion about eggs in the bar. You know, it'll come back. Well, I don't want to give it away. It definitely comes up in the last episode.
I guess I wouldn't describe that as a Chekhov's egg because a Chekhov's gun is like, obviously something with potential energy, like a gun has very much potential problems with it, right? Like you see this gun in the scene and you're like, okay, that evokes something dangerous. An egg doesn't really evoke anything.
I think you're reading too much into the fact that it's an actual gun, like it's a weapon. I mean, if I look up Chekhov's gun on Wikipedia, it says, Chekhov's gun is a narrative principle that states that every element in a story must be necessary and irrelevant elements should be removed. So, for example, if a writer features a gun in the story, there must be a reason for it, such as it being fired sometime later in the plot. So, I mean, in that sense, it's not a weapon.
Yeah, but there's no other... okay, I just disagree with your assessment on the egg. I agree there's multiple egg references, but there's no like, they must use this egg to its full potential for some reason later. What full potential would an egg have? You know, could be wrong about that. But
indeed.
Yeah.
Write that down. And after you watch the next episode, we'll talk about it.
Okay. Okay. Sure.
Okay. That's it. That's all I got. I loved this episode. And I was thinking there was some more stuff in this episode that was ultimately in the last episode. So I'm really interested to watch the last episode again because it's going to be really dense. There's a lot of stuff that still has to come out. So it'll be a fun ride.
Yeah. All right.
Are you interested? Are you still into this, or is it becoming work doing a podcast on it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, this show is not good unless you've watched it before. It seems like.
Really? Okay.
It's like there's all these cool little references, but you don't know about them until later. It'd be nice to be like have like. Pieces in place to like give you satisfying reasons for things happening, but like a lot of things just happen very randomly or like purposefully randomly, seemingly randomly, I guess.
Yeah.
All throughout, even in this episode, a lot of things seem very random, like this horseshoe thing at the end. Like, why is that so random? We're second episode from the last episode. Can't you at least give us like less mystery So the mystery part of it just doesn't intrigue me. I'd rather a show like have meaning as I'm watching it rather than meaning from remembering it, you know, later. Okay. I don't know. But
all right.
So it's a bit frustrating, but I can appreciate, you know, the craft of it for sure.
All right. Well, one episode left. We'll do the next one next week or something. We got to get this knocked out. And then, yeah, I'm curious. We can talk about themes and eggs and characters after the next one, because there's a lot coming up. So,
okay. Sounds good.
All right. Adios.